just something I wanted to point out with all this is that, you know, I'm presently subscribed to, you know, the Verizon Fios service. It's a very good service. I'm, you know, pretty satisfied with it. It's got a very, very fast connection, and I've had it now for about 5 years. But there's one thing I can say about that connection. It's gotten more expensive every year. And when I look at the cost and the increases, which is about over a period of 3 to 4 years, while most of everything has deflated with the economy, the cost of that connection, and of course the other television services have all gone up. And when I look at the area where the cost has gone up the most, taxes, fees, FCC line coverage fees, 911 fees, all these fees that they just keep on adding a one on top of the other. So if I were going to say if the communication and broadband is going to be anything in the near future, taxes, taxes, more taxes. KC2, QIQ.
What a picture you drew, Glenn. What do you believe is the downlink speed that you're getting on Verizon fiber? How many megabits do you think you're able to download when the system is not super busy? I guess I probably want an answer for what
Fios doesn't have the problem with cable.
Okay, but is there a difference in the speed you get at 2 in the morning versus 2 in the afternoon? Over to you, Glenn. How many megabits?
Yeah, I don't think that there's a speed difference, Dick, from day to evening or afternoon. I've checked it, you know, pretty often. It's pretty consistent. But I think the last time I looked at what they were offering me was like 12 in one direction, and I think something like 5 in the other direction. Like, I think it was like 12 and a half and 5, or 4.9 or 4.7, something like that. And I think there's a speed test that they that I checked a couple of times, and pretty close to those numbers.
KC2BG for a comment.
John recognized, but first, Glenn, does that mean you're getting 12 megabits download and 5 megabits upload rate? And is there a premium by which you could get a faster rate, or that's the flat rate everybody gets, to your knowledge? Over to you, Glenn, first.
Well, I know it's been upgraded. They didn't charge me for the upgrade in speed. As a matter of fact, in the last time I checked out all my billing and I called up Fios for, you know, Verizon for everything, they kind of gave me that as a freebie to keep me on from switching over to cable. But I think originally it was like 10 and 2.3 or something like that. It was like 10 and 2. So they actually have increased the speed a little bit, but apparently that's... But the funny part is they've actually held their prices. It's really the taxes that have gone up. That was really the difference there.
And it sounds like you're fairly sure that they're not creating the taxes. The local municipalities apparently are doing that. Okay, we got Rich and Joe in that order. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead. Wait for the beep.
Hey, good evening, Dick, N2EO. You may want to leave this for later, I don't know, but on the subject of the FCC, Eric said he spoke to this commissioner, Mr. Cox. I wonder if Eric or anybody else has any inkling as to whether we can get some more enforcement in amateur radio. Not necessarily regulation, but enforcement of the existing regulations. Back to that.
Let me hear a couple of words about what you're saying, Rich. Right now, I think the manpower to really do a level of enforcement that you and I would desire probably is not there. I have the impression that the majority of the enforcement takes place by way of the amateurs themselves gathering a tremendous amount of irrefutable evidence as to what a particular individual is doing, presenting all of that evidence to the friendly candy company, by which they issue some form of notice saying that you better cease and desist or otherwise this is going to happen. I think you're saying you would rather not have amateur radio operators be forced to do that. You would like the FCC to walk around periodically with a direction-finding truck. I don't blame you for desiring that, but I'm a little bit of the opinion that's not likely to happen. But maybe I've got you wrong on this one. Over to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick, that's exactly what I mean. I mean, I remember years ago, and it is years ago, in the late 60s, there was a problem on one of the lower amateur bands locally here in Queens. I went down at that time to, then it was 641 Washington Street, and I had a very nice chat with Mr. Henry Paulison at the local field office. I brought him some tapes, and he said, well, we have to gather the evidence ourselves. We can only use your tapes to start an investigation. And they did, and some people really got in trouble. They sent the trucks out. I know it's kind of a thing of the past, but it seems like, you know, we've been forgotten about.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. From one point of view, we've been forgotten about. From another point of view, we've picked up the ball and done an awful lot of our own self-policing. And the number of amateurs we have now is two or three times as high as it was then. And the amount of funds that Congress has allocated to the FCC has not been proportional to maintain those services that you're describing. So you and I can dream about getting better. I think we're going to have to continue doing self-policing. That's a guess on my part. Joe, KC2UBG, go right ahead, K2LIW in the TechNet. As I said, nice picture of you with your guitar.
KC2UBG, oh, thank you. The other thing that I wanted to talk about, which no one, it's a very controversial thing, which is in America, we have broadband, yes. And the megabits of what we receive is not actually megabits of what we get. And if we do receive it, it is only for a certain amount of time. So in an example of downloading something or using Skype, a telecommunicational device that is doing video and audio, this drops not because the program is wrong, it's because of the broadband is just coming up and down constantly as you're talking. You're going from 10 megabits to 20, back to 15, then going back up to 20. And this is a big problem with communication.
K2YO.
Go ahead, Betty.
Good evening, Dick and Annette. Just wanted to add a comment to what the gentleman just saying, that most of the Boost services are doing just that, that for your initial page hit, you've got a tremendous amount of download speed, but then for your secondary, tertiary page hit, it's significantly less. So when you run a speed test, it looks like you've got a blazing fast line, but yes, over a long speed tape, you need to download a gigabyte or two, you'll notice that it slows down very quickly after that.
Interesting. Eric, you make use of internet, and left-handedly the speed affects you when it comes to the connection between the eastern machine and the western machine of this particular repeater system. There are days when I see that the time delay between eastern and western machine is a small fraction of a second, and there are times when it probably gets up to 3, 4, 5 seconds. Is that because of the length of the time of the connection, the particular connection that took place that particular day, the routing, and what do you think is going on, is one question, and second of all, I believe you're in the process of eventually circumventing that. KE2EJ, K2LIW on the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, the interesting thing is if you do a trace route at any particular point in time, trace route will actually show you the path. Now, don't forget, the whole concept of TCP/IP is that you can blow up a node somewhere and your data is going to find its way. That was the model that the military wanted when it was originally AlphaNet or DARPANet. And that still holds true today. So, you know, the connection that we make today may not be the same path we get 10 minutes from now. It may not be the same path we get tomorrow. So we could actually be taking a 100-mile path on one day and taking a 10-mile path on another. That's one aspect. Okay, there's propagation delay in that. There's also latency in equipment, whereas that you may be going into a path that's going into an OC-128 or an OC-64 that may get buffered before it actually gets put in. Whereas I have a 100 megabit line between my station in Plainview and the station in New York City. And that's actually a private fiber, so I can have absolute control over you know, how much bandwidth is allocated, because I stream 40 megabits in one direction. I stream 60 megabits constantly in the other. I also have some paths to go to Los Angeles. That sits on an OC128, but we use something called ATM, which is kind of ancient at this point. But out of that 1.16 gigs of bandwidth, I can guarantee that I've got a 60 megabit or 100 megabit hole that's not going to be disturbed by anybody. That's the whole point of ATM. There are methods, are ways of doing things. It was designed into the system. But the Internet, as we know it, the way they operate, you know, you can actually pay for a
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You only timed out for about 5 seconds at the end, Eric. When you're downloading on your private piece of fiber between New York City and your Plainview station at 100 megabit rate, I should know, but... that allows you to download, say for instance you wanted to transmit from New York City to your Plainview site a particular high-def television program that you're going to store and rebroadcast at some later time. But does that allow you to download a one-hour program in, say, 15 minutes? Am I making a rough guess? Eric, can I go ahead?
All right, let me throw you in. That 100 megabit path is used for a couple things. The first thing that it's used for is we actually encode the digital television signal that has the three channels of WLIW, WLIW Create, and WLIW World. It leaves New York City. It goes through this system, this fiber. It winds up at the transmitter site, and it feeds the transmitter in real time. So right there is 20 megabits worth of constant data that's passing all the time. It can't be interrupted by anything, otherwise the pictures that we transmit will burp. Now, I also have 100 megabits going the other direction, whereas that when the studio was active and we were doing pledge and that sort of thing, I would actually put stuff into the server. The server would hang on to it. I would transmit an hour's worth of show in about 10 minutes to New York, and they would have the whole show. That's another purpose. I also send control data. The entire IT operation, the enterprise system within the building, actually even the trunking system for the telephone passes through there, all having its own little space, all being continuously transmitted back and forth without interruption. So you can do things like that.
ACTVG Friday.
Joe recognized. OC192, I think, is 10 gigabits per second, and there's a OC384, which I think is 40 gigabits per second. Is it that the particular fiber was installed at some time before the fiber had that kind of bandwidth, or the transmitting and receiving opto couplers on each end can't yet quite tolerate that speed? What is limiting the speed on your fiber, on your privately owned piece of fiber, Eric? Go ahead.
All right, first of all, the fiber that we have is part of the New York State public broadcast system. Which actually, the fiber actually runs along the Long Island Expressway. It goes up the New York State Thruway and goes all the way to Buffalo. And all the New York State public broadcast stations are connected to it. It's actually a 10 gigabit fiber. And what we do is we allocate, you know, a certain amount of bandwidth for each user. We also share stuff with, and I'll get this to programming from Albany that way. We'll send stuff up to Albany or up to Buffalo. Everybody's got their chunk. And it was basically a dark fiber that runs along these roads, believe it or not. And it's managed by Time Warner, believe it or not, in terms of administering it. It's all controlled from Syracuse to Syracuse station. And we contract to Cablevision and Time Warner throughout the state to do the last mile connections for many of the stations. But the OC-128 that I was talking about is part of a quest system that goes between Los Angeles and New York. And they maintain that. And there's another company called Williams. Most people aren't aware of the name is up. Williams is a pipeline company. They pipe oil from one end of the country to the other. About 25 years ago, 30 years ago, they decided, well, let's not just move oil, let's move television pictures and data. So Williams has a company called Vivix, and also they're part of a system called The Switch, where in each television station you have the ability to hook up to any other TV station within the entire country just by dialing up a number. And that's another business that this oil pipeline company got into, since they had these right-of-ways that run all over the place. Because previous to that, there was a company called Eastern Microwave. If you remember what the tower in Plainview looked like, that was had dishes all over it, and that was a repeater station for Eastern Microwave. They have since gone out of business since becoming a private. K2IOW, K2J.
Interesting. What is the backup to that particular piece of fiber, Eric? If something terrible happens to that particular piece of cable, what would you be using as a backup, if you're allowed to tell me, and that's your choice?
Yeah, I'll tell you precisely. If you look at the top of my tower, there's a dish up there. That one's I got both 12 and 68. That shoots up to the top of 30 Rock. The top of 30 Rock has a repeater in it, which shoots over to 33rd Street. By the same token, if you look up there carefully, you'll see that NBC has a ENG, you know, remotely tunable, steerable receive site to their news operation. They use the other polarization of that microwave. So we're both running through the same dish. I'm horizontally polarized. They're vertically polarized. And we make our connectivity via microwave. So it's very rare that we have rain fade on the microwave, but it happens. And it's only 25 milliwatts.
Are you using the microwave link continuously just to make sure it's operational? And is that a parallel data path along with the fiber path? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it is, actually. I have a dual-stream microwave. One is capable of, one segment is a T1. The other segment is an ATSC path, which is designed to pass ATSC from one place to another. And another segment is a 12 megahertz worth of analog bandwidth.
My goodness, you are connected. The main optical standard, is it OC-128? What made me think it's OC-192, 10 megabits per second? Maybe I've remembered the number incorrectly. Okay, over to you.
No, I think OC-192 is like 10 gigs. OC-128 is 1 or 2 gigs. I forget exactly what it is. OC-64 is 500 megs or 700 megs. You know, the lower the number, the slower it is. But I think they're up to OC-384 or something like that now. But, you know, it's amazing the speed of the diodes and the photo detectors that they have today that they didn't have 5 years ago.
Yeah, I know somebody who worked on a OC-192 system at 10 gigs, and there is a OC-384 at 40 gigs per second. My goodness, can that fiber really handle data rates at extremely low insertion losses? When I was cutting my teeth on spectrum analyzers in the early 70s, Bell Laboratories was working on this quarter of a million telephone conversations in a 2-inch diameter waveguide that they were going to lay across the United States that required a ridiculous straightness in order for it to work. And they thought a quarter of a million telephone conversations all at once was really good using the, what was the name of the propagation mode now? TE01, I think it was called. It was a propagation mode where essentially none of the current flowed on the inside of the pipe itself. My goodness, we've come a long way since then. You visit the Bell Laboratories in Homedale, New Jersey, in, let's say, 1974, which was then a state-of-the-art place. That's also where the Hoghorn antenna that was used by Penzias and Wilson to measure the 2.73 degree Kelvin background noise radio telescope measurement of the Big Bang leftover from space. That was done at that site, and I've essentially walked into that horn, if you know what I mean. There used to be a 60-foot dish there, too, run by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU. So someone told me, I think that place is not even being used now. We've come a long way since then. Thank you, Eric, for any comments on all of the above. You might not have even been around in those days.
You know, what was Bell Labs is now at Baskin Ridge.
And it's actually Lucent.
Lucent Laboratories, you know, it's the same thing, same deal. There's still a lot of development going on, but Lucent actually was bought by a French company called Lacatel. And it used to be, come up with an idea, we'll back you to do what you want. Now it's come up with an idea, show us how we make money, and then maybe we'll think about it. So, you know, it's a different world than it used to be. You know, think about it. It was exactly a single-mode fiber at one particular point in time, and you passed one wavelength of light through it, and you were done. Now we have WDM, wavelength division multiplex. That's one of the ways that Fios works, is they use different colored lights to get different services down the pipe. And they do that under the ocean, they do that over the ground. One fiber used to be a big cable with a single strand of glass in it. Now it's a medium-sized cable with a dozen strands of glass in it. So, you know, who knows what tomorrow's going to bring.
I think that strand of glass now has a graduated refractive index, making it a single-mode fiber. The signal is not really bouncing and creating a dispersion, and as such, although that's a more difficult fiber to generate, it now gives you beautiful broadband characteristics. And by the way, I slowly fell in love with Daljit Dhaliwal and World Focus, and all of a sudden, I think you've gone back to BBC. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, you don't want to get me started on that. We used to call it World Blankets, if I can't say it on the air. Ever since Dr. Bill was kind of pushed out the door, the new guy that you see with his suspenders on used to be the vice president of NBC News, and to this day I still don't really think he understands that he works for a nonprofit. He seems to know how to spend money and not generate it. So, you know, after you spend $8, $10, $12 million on creating a show, if you don't get any funding, your show goes bye-bye.
Will BBC stay, or is this a temporary condition from your point of view? Eric, go ahead.
I really shouldn't say this, but this is very prejudicial on my part. We used to actually make money from the BBC. We distributed it to all the other stations in the country. And in the process of that, it generated some income for the station. Well, BBC decided at that point that they were going to improve their branding. They were going to, for more information on this story, go to www.bbc.com. And the new guy didn't like that idea, so he thought, well, we're not going to deal with you anymore. We'll do our own thing. And the Los Angeles station had been trying to get it from us for years, and now the Los Angeles station, we pay money to put the BBC on. Now, it's not going to go anywhere. It's just costing us a whole bunch.
One of the things that was brought out during that Bill Maher's program was that the alternate stream of data that the American public gets by way of BBC, by way of PBS, I think he said that the average citizen is paying $1.35 per year, or some crazy number like that, whereas many other countries, probably by way of subsidizing, are paying many, many times that for the independent source of information, telecommunication, news, and whatever. Did I remember those numbers incorrectly, Eric? Go ahead.
No, you got it right. And actually, the Congress has been slowly deleting, making that number smaller and smaller. And PBS is hurting quite badly, actually. The new show that we're coming up with is called Need to Know, which should be good, although there's a lot of mixed opinion about it. The funding for CBB and PBS as we know it has been reduced quite considerably over the years, especially during the last Republican administration. They seem to want to not have, free speech, so to speak, or news that's unbiased. I mean, the NewsHour is kind of like considered to be the most trusted news source on television, but you know what? The NewsHour has a bunch of guys running it that are a little bit jilted, too.
Yeah. Although, I think they try hard. Why can't it? McNeil Lair Report. Were those the good old days, or am I showing my age?
When Robin was part of it, it was the best thing you could find. When it was became just Jim Lair, I mean, you know, Robin's still around. He still produces the show. He still does a lot of other stuff. But the level of control that the two of them had over content is has been diminished greatly, let's put it that way.
I know I'm getting off subject here, but one other thing that I'm quite interested in is Scientific American Frontiers with Alan Alda. Is there a fixed number of those that are produced, or are more of those are coming down the pipeline? Go ahead.
I hate to tell you, but that show's been out of production for, what, 5 years, 6 years, huh?
My goodness, am I living in the past. Okay. So I think you're saying the only really new stuff is things like Nature and Nova, and you're saying Scientific American Frontiers is really just being recycled, and I guess you're saying that it stopped being produced some good number of years ago. No chance of it coming back. Alan is getting too old to do that, or there's no replacement person, or people don't think that it's there's enough demand for it.
No, you still see Alan. He's working on other projects. He's also, you know, doing movies and other stuff, too. You know what I'm not aware of? Nova Science Now with Mr. Degrassi. I know they stopped, but I think they're supposed to start again. Actually, let me look it up. I don't know if they actually went back into production or what. Give me a second, I'll tell you.
Yeah, Neil Degrassi Tyson had a beautiful one in which he went through the whole investigation of what happened to Pluto and how it got downgraded, how it got discovered, and how it got downgraded. And that was a fun show to watch. I also saw another beautiful show way back in the dark ages of, 3 or 4 years ago, called The Greening of Long Island, where the chief engineer was a guy named Eric. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, Nova Science Now last season was this past year. Let's see. No, I don't think anything slated for 2010, so maybe they stopped producing it. The Greening of Long Island, those kinds of shows, right now with the station being as depressed as it is. Oh, here we go. Supposedly it's still in production. I just haven't seen it. Right now you're seeing very little stuff because there's no money to produce things. I think the last thing the station produced was the Lucero thing, which I actually did out of Stony Brook because we got the studio for free.
It's your TVG. Go ahead, Joe.
My comment on television is that it's become interesting now that money funding television now has become such of a loss. But things like Hulu, which is a video distribution of on-the-internet content, has grown greatly over the last couple of years, months. It's become more and more of a content source than actually watching it over the TV antenna. Over to you, Dick.
It's possible that Mel and I are rare birds because we're still watching over-the-air broadcast television. He's not on cable. I'm not on cable. We're dinosaurs. But with 100 feet of tower on 300 feet of land in Huntington, and I can watch television from New Jersey, New York, Connecticut. On a good day, I can go beyond that many states. And if I fix my antenna, I can start doing some digital television DXing, which I'd like to start doing, like Joe W2RYY has been doing. I got to get through all that. So there's just some kind of a hang up I've got on paying for cable TV. Emma.
And we have an unrelated question.
Yeah, go ahead, Wesley.
By the way, the new season of Nova Science now starts in the summer.
Glad to hear it. You got it, Wesley.
Just a quick question. You, at the beginning of today's night, you have made the comments about the true RMS voltmeters, and you said that some people, they have a problem when they claim that they get access of energy. And I was just thinking about it, and if they use the same tool to measure the voltage in both places before the input and the output, then this event could not happen. Do you understand that? Back to you.
Have you asked to what? We're going to go to Paul in a minute. What you just said, Wesley, is very good common sense. And you'd be amazed how much Mother Nature is going to fight you on that one. The input power is charging an inductor, and that gives you one particular wave shape, which you read on a non-true RMS meter as lower than real power. When the inductive kickback comes for the power output, you get a different wave shape that a non-true RMS meter reads higher than reality. So good common sense that you would be wrong in the same direction on both input power and output power. Two entirely different wave shapes. One is a charging wave shape, one is a discharging wave shape. One gets red low, that's the one going in. One gets red high, that's the one coming out. So that is one of the factors that explains some of the results with these rotary magnetic machines that appear to be giving excess energy. So a true RMS meter there on input and output is definitely required, and some of that advantage will go away when that kind of instrumentation is being used. Does that make some sense, Wesley? Go ahead.
It does, but not necessarily to the extent of it. And the reason for that is that that's why I put already two oscilloscopes and quite a few high voltage probes. Is that I just want to know, and I want to make sure that what I'm getting is what I'm seeing. Back to you.
If you buy a modern enough digital oscilloscope, it has many, many digital functions built in, some of which will integrate the power under the curve and tell you true RMS power of any particular voltage or current waveform. So if it's a modern enough digital type oscilloscope, the information you're looking for is going to be there. Paul, tell us what's going on in space. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. And yeah, I'll do that. By the way, this whole house on PBS, I think, is one of the best shows. Very, very good. Those guys do a very good job on that. You probably like that, Dick, as well. SDO, Solar Dynamic Observatory. I don't know if you saw this on the internet. Pictures from the sun, you know, looking at the sun. Fantastic. Big difference between what they used to be able to see and what they can see now. This thing was launched back in March. I remember we talked about SDO on the net back in probably January or early February before it was launched. It's in a 22,000 mile orbit, and it was a pretty good size vehicle. But they did use the Atlas V to put it up there. Good size there. That's now a big launch vehicle now. The Atlas V, and basically it takes pictures in ultraviolet. Let me drop it a second. And the pictures on the net is they have either still pictures or movie pictures, because this thing takes pictures every 10 seconds instead of The best satellite that they ever had up there to take pictures was every 3 minutes. And you could see these ejections of, you know, that come off the sun. Or everything moving. It's a pretty good pictures. It's excellent. 1.5, 1.5 terabytes of information are coming down from the satellite every day. Every day. From what I read, it was a 500,000, the equivalent of a 500,000 CD songs that you could download on a computer. So it's also taking scientific measurements. Solar magnetic fields being evaluated. And the biggest cameras that have ever been put up to take pictures of the sun. And to give you an idea of the pixel size, this is 15 megapixels. The Hubble, when that was put up, was 5 megapixels. This is 16. So they've come a long way. Well, Hubble was back in 1990. They just had their anniversary. But I thought I'd mention the Solar Dynamic Observatory. Let me drop it. And, of course, the manned space program. I'll just mention that we have 3 space shuttle flights left. Atlantis just is going to be the next one. The last one just came back, something like 15 days, and just a couple more flights. September will be the last space shuttle flight. And then on the news recently, I just saw one clip. Yeah, Air Force launched an unmanned satellite. I mean, the thing looks like a little space shuttle. And they call it the X-37, X-37B. And it's one of these DARPA projects started out with NASA, and NASA gave up with it and became a DARPA project. So it's really a military flight. It's going to come back and eventually land somewhere probably in California. And again, it looks like a little space shuttle. And it's a top secret thing where you really don't get any information about it. We drop it. But it too was launched on an Atlas V, so it was a good size thing. It's about 25% the size of a space shuttle. And very similar to the X-38. X-38 was it looks like that type of a vehicle, lifting body type vehicle. X-38 was another spacecraft that was canceled some years ago. They went through billions of dollars of testing. That definitely looked like a small shuttle without any windows. It was going to be attached to the International Space Station permanently, and then if there was an emergency, they were going to use it as a lifeboat. You could put up to 7 astronauts on board, and it was going to come down through the atmosphere with a parasail and skis and land. And they got as far as testing the landing of it, and they canceled the program. It kind of reminds me of that a little bit. I mean, it's you know, a short wing type of vehicle. So that's pretty much it on that, Dick. I thought I'd really bring up the SDO, the Solar Dynamic Observatory. You should really check that out on the internet, Dick. Back to you, WS.
I did check that out on their so-called first light set of pictures. A person who goes to http://spaceweather.com. No www required. Spaceweather.com. You'll see the SDO. If you Google the word SDO, Solar Dynamic Observatory, you'll see some of these really beautiful high-resolution pictures that it's starting to take. And it's doing quite a bit of solar seismology. In other words, it looks at the waves that are occurring across the sun and figuring out what's going on in the interior. The sun really continuously rings like a bell, so to speak. And also the latest issue of Scientific American has got a nice article about neutrinos. By way of the neutrino telescopes that are now in operation and slowly growing in resolution, the nice thing about a neutrino is it allows you literally look directly inside of the sun and see what's going on in the nuclear reaction in the dead center. And it doesn't matter if the sun is up or down. Those neutrinos go right through the Earth so easily that you can be doing neutrino solar observation even though your telescope is on the far side of the Earth from the Sun at that particular time. Crazy stuff. So lots and lots going on. Mel, I know we were going to set aside some more time tonight for your explanation of the way you use a Smith chart with a 25 ohm resistor. There's a darn little time left. I know we're going to just frustrate the daylights out of you. It's your choice. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah. Well, I know I got a lot of email on it. And all right, let me just clarify one point here. There's confusion. It's still confusion with FWR and what it means. And let me just clarify one simple thing in the time we have left. If you put a load of 150 ohms, you will get a 3-to-1 SWR based on a 50 ohm. We're talking about 50 ohm system. If we went ahead and we put 16.767 ohms into a system, we can get a 3-to-1 SWR. So the SWR is a series, basically, of very complex impedance conversions. And that is basically, you know, however, that's why I specified this one particular resistor I was using, which is the 27 ohm. I hope I made that a little clearer, Dick, over.
You definitely did. If you get on your Smith chart and you put the pointer, the sharp point of your compass right on the center of the Smith chart, and the pencil itself, you put it on the number 3.0 on the horizontal line to the right-hand side, use that as a radius, and swing that circle. That is a 3-to-1 circle. Every one of those dots along that circle represents all the possible ways of making 3-to-1. The far right-hand side represents 3 times 50 ohms, 150 ohms. The far left-hand side, when you calculate it, represents 16.666 ohms. So either a pure resistor, 16.66, or a pure resistor of 150 connected down the end of a 50 ohm line is a 3-to-1. There's a whole bunch of other dots up and down from that point where some amount of reactance with some amount of resistance also gives you 3-to-1. And so a guy knows he's got 3-to-1 and now he wants to know where he is to know how to correct it. Over to you, Mel. K2RIW.
Okay. Yeah. And basically, by putting that resistor into the FET and measuring it, basically the intent here was to get you, as they say, well, you get into the ballpark. It's an old cliche. Because when you are making that measurement, as Dick said, every spot, basically, along that circle, the circle passes through all the resistive and reactive pairs which would produce this 3-to-1 SWR that we used in the example. Is that simple enough to put it that way, Dick? Over.
Right on. So if you made that circle into a whole bunch of dots instead of a continuous line, every one of those dots represents some combination of an R and an X that's exactly a 3-to-1 visoir. So if you know your antenna is 3-to-1, it's somewhere on that circle. And now if you're smart enough in the way you add a 27.5 ohm resistor, I think it is, to the antenna connection directly, you can get a lot of good information. The thing that's a little bit complicated is you want to know what the antenna is. And sure, it would be nice if you could make the measurement from the shack after the other end of the transmission line of unknown length. That's quite a bit more difficult. Although by frequency sweeping techniques, I'll bet you can get there. Over to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY, yes. So we make another circle with the resistor in, and the second circle gives you, say, a VSWR of 2-1, the this is also representing, in other words, a point, again, along the circle where all the resistive and the reactive pairs can be produced by a 2-1 SWR. So now what I wanted to do was find two points, whether it be the inductive or the capacitive point, I made the third circle. So that's why I have the three circles. And the third circle actually intersects the second circle at a point, at two points. So the points are, if it's up above the line, it's plus J. If it's below the line, it's minus J. So in this case, if we did all the calculations, we want to know which of the two is the, as to say, is the correct situation in this particular example. Over.
And now what I've heard last week is that you take the 3-1 circle, move to the right of the 3-1 circle along the resistive line to the right of the center of the chart. You move to the point 3.5. You then go over to the right-hand side of the 2-1 circle, and you move to the left to where it's 1.5. So you've made a dot along the resistive line to the right of center at 1.5 and 3.5. And then I believe you put the sharp point of your compass on one of those, and then the pencil on the other, and you swing that third circle, which is going to intersect the 2-1 or the 3-1, I'm not quite sure which, in those two different spots. The intersection is what you care about. Now, moving to 3.5 and moving to 1.5 confuses me a little, because you didn't use a 25-ohm resistor. That would be 0.5 relative, you know, when normalized. You're using a 27.5-ohm resistor. Does that mean you move a little bit more than 3.5 and a little bit more than 1.5? Over to you, Mel. K2LIW.
Yeah, it was actually a 25-ohm resistor. Actually, I did the calculation eventually out to 27 ohms, but it was basically, you know, from what I could measure, around 25 ohms, the resistors. If you remember those old carbon resistors, the plus or minus about 10%, so I think I found one around 25 ohms, so I rounded it off just for argument's sake. My basic reason for doing this was some way I wanted to do at my antennas, fooling around at the antenna bases, whether I am looking at plus J or minus J. This is what I thought of when I did this trick. And to get the exact accuracy, you know, right to the point, was not my intent. So when I came up with 27.5 ohms resistive and 36 ohms reactive, that gave me an idea, but I wanted to know whether it was plus or minus really at that point, because I know I could compensate, you know, with a capacitor and inductor, but just tell me, which way am I going, over?
Okay, let me assume now that the antenna in question happened to really be nothing but 150 ohms resistive and no reactance. I see it coming. Obviously, when I added a 25-ohm resistor, I would not jump down to 2-1. I would jump up to something like 3.5. The fact that your antenna jumped from 3-1 down to 2-1 when you added the 25/27-ohm resistor, that's what allowed you to swing the circle. And once again, circle number 3 is the sharp point on 1.5 and the pencil on 3.5 before you swing. And you care where circle number 3 hits 2-1, because that's where you ended up. So, do I have that part correctly, Mel? Go ahead.
That's exactly. Put the pin on the 1.5, open the compass up to 3.5, swing the circle where it where it goes to the 2.0 through the 2.1. You see it actually, by the way I did it here, like I say, you know, most likely not the most accurate, but I came up with 1.05 plus J 0.72 or 1.05 minus J 0.72, Dick. That's basically I could resolve, you know, the way I did it, over.
Okay, I think I see the process. Have you tried it with any other combination of R and X? Because a 3-to-1, I see it coming though. Any other combination but that combination would not jump from 3-to-1 down to 2.1. And I think you're telling me you have used this exact procedure with other chosen antenna impedances, and you're always adding the resistor right at the antenna. I don't think you, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not sure you have come up with a procedure yet that you can use in the shack without knowing the exact length of the cable, electronic length of the cable. Over to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Oh, you're 100% right. No, you couldn't. No, I did this for a number of, I made a number of different times. I've had different situations here. I saw, I had a situation here, a number of them that I plotted. The idea of this was, I was up to that time, you know, I was using a noise bridge. But with a noise bridge, I needed some kind of receiver. And I needed something, you know, that give me some kind of accuracy of the readout, you know, as far as the frequency and all. I didn't have anything like that. And I was doodling around. I said, there must be a way I could do this at the antenna and get some kind of a really, you know, definitive answer that makes some kind of sense. When I had somebody came along with a general radio bridge. They have a nice, had a nice piece of equipment, costly piece of equipment, but when I did this, you know, I just wanted to see if I was in the ballpark again, and it seemed like it was always pretty good. Now, a number of people did the same experiments here. They did email me and said, gee, it really does work, and then putting that capacitor in, let me let it drop it. And using a variable capacitor for the last test, once you've made this measurement to determine whether you are, plus or minus, by now observing the SWR, the original SWR with adding capacitance, see whether now you are inductive or if you were. The antenna was more capacitive by seeing if the SWR goes up or down. They said works real well. So, yes, mathematically it may not be the most accurate, but listen, when you're going to add either inductance or capacitance, you know, you're going to have a variable situation anyhow there to compensate over.
WA2VDH with a comment. Go ahead, Joe. No, that's John.
Fine business. Yeah, I was just looking at the Smith chart. It looks like if you take every point on the 3-to-1 SWR circle and unnormalize it, multiply it by 50, and then add the 25 to the resistive part and then renormalize it again, it will take you onto that offset circle. It seems to work out for the resistor part as well as the reactor load. Go ahead, Dick.
If I understand correctly, what you're saying, John, is that you take the 3-to-1 circle and every portion of it, you add a 25 or a 27 ohm resistor. I think you're saying that allows you to draw what Mel is calling circle number 3. Is that what you said, John? Go ahead.
That's the circle with the offset center. It takes you to that locus of points. That is by first taking every point on a 3-to-1 circle and then unnormalizing it, bringing it back to actual impedance, then adding 25 to the resistive part, and then dividing by 50. It'll take you to that offset circle. Go ahead.
Interesting. I've got to do that experiment. And does that draw circle number 3 as a perfect circle, or is it slightly elliptical when you carry that process out? Back to you, John.
Well, it looks like it's a circle, but its center is offset, which is why Mel added that, why he shifted the center from the 1 plus J0 point over to that 1.5 plus J0, moved it to the right on the resistive line. Go ahead.
Okay, I've got to try that. So you took every point of the 3.0, went back to the unnormal. Well, you added 25 ohms to what every one of those points was with proper normalization and redrew a circle. And I think you're saying that became Mel's circle number 3. Okay, I've got to do it a little more accurately, and I've got to do some more experimenting with it. What you guys just heard is technet number 1,294. of the network of the group of technets that began in September of 1982, 27 and a half years ago. I'm going to have to go away for a while because I got to go to work tomorrow. Mel is one of those retired guys. I used to be, but I'm not retired anymore. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. And over to you, Mel, to do whatever you like. K2KEY, K2LIW. And YO first. Go ahead, Bernie.
Just as a housekeeping issue, Dick and Mel, I wanted to congratulate you. We set a new record tonight. We had a listener as far away as the Red Sea in Saudi Arabia. So we had people from Trinidad and Tobago, Australia, California. There's a JE sign. I couldn't verify it, but I believe that it was somebody in Japan. And then our usual friends in Kentucky and Las Vegas. So it was a very, not to forget Kuwait City also. So congratulations. You are officially, definitely international now.
Impressive. How did these people find out where to tune to find the technical net? Where was the advertisement that the people in each one of those countries know where to look? Bernie, go ahead.
Many of the U.S. ones, our friends in Las Vegas, our friends in Kentucky, have been regular listeners. There's a gentleman up in the Bronx that runs a large DX network. I don't have his call sign at the moment, but he connected his group in, which brought a lot. Actually, his name is Tom, KB2HZE, and he brought many of the international people there. So basically, a friend telling friends about it.
Interesting. Okay, thank you for that information.
Also listed on the IRLP website, by the way, Dick. It looks like we have a listener from Malaysia.
Malaysia right now. What is it, high noon there right now, Eric?
Probably.
Thank you. You got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, so that's why I get a lot of emails, and I guess I'm going to get some more now from other places in this world. And, yeah, basically, these experiments are with the Smith chart. I know I have some of them submitted years ago to Ham Radio, and Jim Fisk, he says a lot of it was sort of hocus-pocus. So I just bring them up every so often, and I like to hear, you know, what other people think of these experiments or ideas that I have originated. Believe me, I did not invent the Smith chart, of course. Mr. Smith did it. I just apply it. Maybe some of my ways I apply the Smith chart a little unorthodox. But if you do some of these experiments, they do make some sense. I don't claim that they're as accurate as, you know, mathematically it could be. But, okay, as they say, investigate. Let us know. We're interested to hear. 73's everybody. Got to go to work also. Just don't give me this business retired. Unsuccessfully retired. 73, catch you all next week. Thank you all for joining. This is K2KEY.
I thought you were retired. Do you work 5 days a week like I do, Mel?
Oh, not 5 days a week, but I don't have to punch a clock. That's the point, Dick. Over.
And I don't punch a clock either. Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye, you all.
K2RAW, K2YO for a quick moment.
Go ahead, Bernie. Go ahead, Bernie.
Sorry about that, Echolink wasn't dropping. Just want to give you an FYI. You heard how I broke in a couple of times tonight with that mechanized voice? That's how people over Echolink can now break in. If they type the right code into their Echolink browser, it'll speak their call sign like that. So I just want to give you a heads up. When you hear that, there are two different messages you'll hear. One is when they join the link. We're eventually going to take that one away. But when you just hear a call sign mechanized spoke like that, that means that somebody is wishing to break into the conversation.